Hello, how are you? This is the Cornelius Cast from Cornelius Racing. Please do feel free to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Have a listen. Here we go.
I was just thinking. Hello, by the way. Cornelius here. Cornelius Lycett here. I was just thinking that I left the BBC on April the 30th, 2020. And I was just thinking about what I've missed most. Obviously, the chance to report frontline, if you like, on racing, do lots of racing interviews, and also the chance to go to the races. Haven't been since Cheltenham Gold Cup Day on Friday, the 13th of March. But actually, the funny thing I've realised is that when sports people in particular, but others as well, talk about leaving something they've done for quite a long time, they talk about the camaraderie of, in jockeys' cases, in the weighing room. And I've sort of known exactly what they mean, because you spend quite a lot of time working closely with, in the racing media case, some pretty terrific people. None more so, I have to say, than four who are in the inevitable WhatsApp group that has been formed. They are Marcus Tannend of The Mail, Dave Yates of The Mirror, Marcus Armitage of The Telegraph, and Steve Jones, who's a columnist now on The Mirror as well. And I'm pleased to say that one of those, Marcus Tannend, is here now. Hello, how's it going?
Very good, Cornelius. Yeah, very good. Very pleased to be described as one of the terrific people. Blimey, that's made me smile.
Well, I was going to call you wise next, actually. I've written down here, I mentioned the five wise men, the five old farts, if you like, on our WhatsApp group. But, you know, from Alistair Down, John Hunt, my ex-BBC colleague, Rob Wright on The Times, and in the past, people like the late Alan Lee, the late Chris Poole, the late George Enner, Claude Duval, still going from The Sun. It is actually terrific. No, I don't think that's an unfair or a ridiculously over the top description.
No, I think there is a camaraderie there. I think you drew the analogy with the weighing room, and I think to a certain extent there are some similarities there. You know, we travel around in a sporting context, following the sport which we are involved in or are covering, moving from racecourse to racecourse, from festival fixture to fixture. And so, you know, we spend our lives not only in the working environment, but quite a lot of time in a social environment as well, because we have to stay away from these meetings. So, we mix socially as well as in the working environment. So, and the other thing about it, I suppose, is that there is the other analogy to the weighing room is that there's a bit of a competitive streak, isn't there, as well? All the jockeys are trying to beat each other in races, and we're probably trying to beat each other in getting stories for our respective organisations.
Exclusives. Everything seems to be exclusive in the Daily Mail.
Oh, I think there's a bit of a pop there. We like to deal in exclusive, don't we, for reporters? We like to think we maybe get a bit of an edge on our rivals.
Do you think the public cares? I always wonder about whether when the BBC says this exclusive report from blah, blah, blah. Do people care?
I don't think the public care at all. Probably, I think I think that it's probably it's probably just done for the benefit of us all and benefit of the industry. But it is, I suppose, if you're without being too frivolous about it, it is a sort of a you know even if you're talking about television or things like that, you know, people like to build up a preview things, don't they, and build them up in presentation style, and sort of billing a story as exclusive is a presentational tool, isn't it? You're trying to grab people's attention to sort of draw them in, that this is a bit of news that they maybe haven't heard before, and you won't read it anywhere else apart from here.
I have to smile slightly, because the Mail at the moment is keen on the e-word exclusive. And I remember attending one of the social events you were talking about with other people in the social media many years ago, and your predecessor as racing correspondent of the Mail was Colin McKenzie, and you did joke at the time that he put exclusive on so many stories you thought he changed his name by deed poll to McKenzie-exclusive.
I don't think that went down too well. I don't know. But it's a sort of a tool of the trade a little bit, but also a little bit of a... We sort of know there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek with it a little bit, and we like to pull each other's legs, don't we? When we see colleagues who are claiming a massive story, which some of us think isn't maybe as massive as they try to present it.
And actually, to be fair to Colin, who's writing his memoirs at the moment, which should be quite exciting, he did... We won't go on about this now. He goes on about it enough. But he did come up with the exclusive of the 20th century. Nothing to do with racing. But I'm sure in his book we'll hear how he found the great train robber Ronnie Biggs in South America. And I think he was hiding in Brazil, wasn't he? And I think the title of his memoirs is going to allude to that. I was just thinking, talking about sort of long-term colleagues and camaraderie, etc. The great thing about racing is the form book is there, and there are so many form books for jump racing, flat racing, or weather racing, etc., that if you're sure you met somebody on a certain occasion, you can actually work it out when it was. Do you know what you were doing, I think, Marcus, on the 21st, Saturday the 21st of December, 1991?
Well, I wouldn't claim I've got the greatest memory in the world at all, and I'm probably struggling to what I was doing last December, never mind at the start of the 1990s, so I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Well, yeah, we were both at Musselburgh Races in Scotland, right, not too far from Edinburgh, and you were the part owner of a bit of a legend of a racehorse called Master of the House. And on that date, the 21st of December 1991, he ran at Musselburgh, as I say. He finished second. Shane Lyons, who now assists his brother Jer as a trainer, assistant trainer in Ireland, rode your horse. Richard Fahey was riding, now training. Roger Marley was riding, now big noise in the bloodstock world. Chris Grant, now training, he was riding. Dave Bentley was riding, he's training in America. Mark Dwyer, Lorcan Wire, Jason Callahan, Russ Garrity. Gosh, there's some names from the past, aren't there?
Blimey, there are, yeah. Now you mention the day, I'm trying to think of big back memories of it. Obviously, my interest in racing started when I was at school, really, and part of the reason was, although I'm not from a racing background, you know, my father was born and brought up in Beverley, which at the time was quite a racing centre. It wasn't just a town with a race course, there were a number of trainers in the town as well. So he knew trainers and jockeys and... Brian Connaughton, and who was the father of Nicky Connaughton, who some people may remember, the jockey, and there was Snowy Gray, the trainer, and Alf Smith, and Jeff Toft, who trained the brilliant Gunner B.
So these were lots of stables in and around the town, were they?
Yeah, oh yeah, and really sort of, really in the town, you know, the Gunner B, who, you know, went on to, in his four-year-old career, was moved down to Sir Henry Cecil and won the Eclipse Stakes. Jeff Toft trained him in a small... There are old bars which are basically sort of turreted roadways into the town, and it was within the bar, and it was behind the Burgess ice cream shop was where the Jeff Toft stable was, and that was where Gunnerby was trained.
And do you remember this from your? Do you remember Beverley like this in your youth?
Oh, God, yes. My dad had the village shop. We were bought, as a proportion, in East Yorkshire Village. My dad had a shop. Once a week, we used to go to the docks in Hull and pick up fruit and veg from the market. We called Humber Street on the River Humber, and all the bananas, all the oranges, all that stuff. So when I was little, that was one of my... I think it was a Thursday. That was the trip into town to the market to buy this. So we used to go. The roads were different in those days. We used to go through Beverley, and my dad still had family in Beverley, so we used to make it a bit of a family trip as well. But we used to drive past the racecourse. If you drove past the racecourse, to your left as you drove into Beverley, which is what is now a small housing estate, was Snowy Gray's racing stables. And although it wasn't as successful when I remember it, you know, Snowy Gray, I think, trained a Dante winner, I think, or it certainly had some decent horses.
Yeah,
plenty
of good horses.
And so I used to drive past, used to occasionally see horses on the Westwood, which is the common land on which the racecourses stood. The gallops were set back from the road, but they were tan gallops because
tan,
which that's like the waste product of the leather business, tanneries, you know. So
right. These were on the ground.
Yeah, they were like forerunners of all weather gallops, basically. So you know, before wood chip and all these fancy sort of polytrack and equitrack, that's what they had at Beverley, and they were the waste products of the tannery business. They were part of the gallops for the Beverley trainers. Yeah.
And that's what really got you interested.
Well, that's what got me into it. Yeah. So I've gone around the houses on this story a lot, haven't I? But then my dad loved racing as well as I did. He'd worked quite hard in running the village shop. Never had a lot of time off really. And we retired, and I was sort of I had just a few quid spare at the time. I didn't have any family or anything like that. And
backed a few winners.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say necessarily that, but I said to him, why don't we buy a small share in a racehorse. So at the time, Mickey Hammond had been a pretty successful jockey. I don't think he'd been training very long, but he'd started off pretty well training in Midland. So I rang him up and said, you know, have you got a small share, you know, anything that really, you know, we want it ready to run. We don't want to hang around for a long time. And he had this horse, which we got back to the start of the story, called Master of the House. And I think we probably bought our share, possibly even, it could have even been earlier that week. Mickey said, I think, you know, we've got a horse, you know, who's just what you're looking for. He runs quite a lot. He's fairly sound. He's flattened jumps. If you buy into him, he's running at Muscle Run on Saturday, sort of thing, and I think we did, and I can definitely remember travelling. We drove to York Station and parked at York Station, and travelling up to Musselburgh by train.
I'd never been there. I think that's why I went. I was staying with some friends in Cumbria, and staying with John Budden, who was a well-known commentator. Racecourse commentator at the time, had a very, very, very fruity voice. He used to when he was commentating, and you could always tell John used to like to have the Budden fiver on one, and you could always tell in his commentary if he'd had the Budden fiver on one, and it was winning, because he used to say X, Y, Z, strides clear, absolutely no danger whatsoever. And if he said absolutely no danger whatsoever, you knew that you were in. And he's still John, one of the great characters of racing in the north of England, with the Budden fiver. And I remember, and Musselburgh has actually become a really real sort of favourite racecourse of mine. But that Master of the House, I think it taught me a lesson that I didn't know about racing, which, because the name is spelt Master, then a space, then of the, all one word, and then another space, and then house. And I don't think I quite appreciated that if you're going to name a racehorse, 18 is the magic number, isn't it? So in order to squeeze the name into the amount of spaces allowed, Master of the House, the of the, had to all be run together. He won a few races, didn't he?
Well, he did, unfortunately not for us.
Did he win the Carlisle Bell or a Cumberland Plate or a proper race like that?
You're asking me now to retell a painful story.
Well, tell it quickly.
Well, I think I'm right in saying that he was, if not bred, certainly owned originally by Peter Saville, who at the time was quite a big sort of racing figure and still has horses.
And views.
And views, yeah. He obviously went on to be BHB chairman, didn't he, I think, at one point. Yeah, he was a remarkably consistent horse. And the great thing was that whenever you went to the racecourse and whenever he ran, and my dad and my mother went far more than I did, he invariably ran well. You know, he invariably finished in the frame, but he hardly ever won, really, right, for us. And in the end, he won a couple of races over hurdles at Perth, which is another one of your favourite racecourses.
Favourite racecourse. And I remember you and I went to Perth from the south of England to watch Master of the House. And the first first person who came up to us when we arrived was Mickey Hammond, or one of Mickey Hammond's stable staff, and said, "Oh, he's lame or something, wasn't it? And he can't run."
That's it. Yeah. No, we drove up from Midland. You were in the front of the car with Mickey. I was in the back of the car with Jumbo Wilkinson. Can you remember the late Jumbo Wilkinson, the great trainer? Yeah. With him telling some great stories. And we got there, and the secretary had phoned up and said, the horse is lame, he can't run. Unfortunately, he picked up an injury, having run fantastically well for us. And, you know, because we were just want, you know, I think there was a question mark at the time whether he'd run again, but he certainly needed a reasonable time off. So because we were just sort of in it for a bit of fun, and getting my dad out to the races and stuff like that, we said let's buy into something else, and we got out of Master House, and then slightly unfortunately, then when he came back having been injured, he went on this fantastic winning run, including. Is it the country's oldest race, the Carlisle Bell or whatever? So we watched in horror as this horse who we'd, you know, enjoyed. Horror's too strong a word, but we watched with slight mixed feelings that this horse had really run well for us and had given us some great enjoyment, but suddenly had come back and seemed to have sort of sprouted an extra leg and kept winning all these races.
But just because obviously the main thing that you and I have done in racing is media, but we've both been lucky enough to have little shares in little horses. And you know, there's lots more to talk about on the Cornelius cast today. But how big a thrill when you have a share. You know, we were lucky enough a couple of times with a filly called Zahir to win. How big a thrill did you find it to actually see that side of the equation?
Oh, it was a great thrill. You know, when you go to the races, and you know, whether you're involved in it professionally or you're just there as a, you know, as a passionate sort of fan, I think the feelings are the same. You know, you go there, you know, your expectations are often high. You experienced all the lows as well, of which obviously there are far more than the highs. Yeah, but I also think that from our point of view, as both sort of work. Doing the work we do, I think it was a valuable experience for me, because I got to see it, even only as a small shareholder, I got to experience the ownership sort of thing and experience what owners do, and I think that we sometimes can look at owners and sort of say, well, they're always moaning about prize money, or they're always moaning about this and that. But you know, I've experienced that a lot, and I think that things have improved a lot, obviously, since the early 1990s. But I do think that there is a lot more that can be done for owners to make the experience a lot more rewarding, because the run is only part of owning a racehorse, and the run is only about 5 minutes, if you're lucky, every month, yeah. Really, isn't it? And that, when you're paying for a horse for the entire year, the whole sort of round experience should be part of that ownership sort of thing, really.
I'm going to talk about owners again in just a second, but people listening to me on the BBC and some of the writing I've done know that I enthuse about Perth racecourse we were talking about. We went that day and the horse was a non-runner. Have you been to Perth since that day, do you think?
I don't think I have, no.
But can you, just winding back the clock, can you see the charm that I find about the place? Can you see how much I've loved it?
Oh, certainly, yeah. It was a great racecourse, and obviously I'm from Yorkshire originally, but I live in the south, which is probably why I don't get the opportunity to go to Perth as often as I would like. Do you know what my bizarre memories that you get, but one of my abiding memories of arriving at Perth that day, and I can still, you know, stick, I don't know why it sticks in my mind, really, is that it's the Scone Palace Estate, isn't it, there? And we drove through the gates or whatever, and you'll know the layout better than I do, and there were just these flocks of pheasants walking across the road. I don't know why I remember that, but there were just great flocks of pheasants.
I think you'd find them there. You'd find them there today, as long as they're not during the shooting season, where people are allowed to have a pop at them.
Yeah. It's a very sort of tweedy set, isn't it? There, I think I remember that as well.
It's probably a bit more commercial now than it was in those days, but it was very much the county set who were supporters. But you know, racing in Scotland, Musselburgh, Perth, and also Kelso and Hamilton and Ayr. In those days, it was sort of slightly the poor relation, I think, of British racing, but not so much now. And Scottish racing, the five of them work reasonably well together, and they're going pretty strong. That's one of the things I've missed, actually, during the lockdown, is there was no racing at Perth, the three-day festival at the end of April, and must be touch and go whether the public will be allowed in for the 2 days in September. So what's been reporting behind closed doors, having to rely on colleagues to supply quotes and information from the races, etc.? What's it been like for you, and indeed for Daily Mail readers and Mail on Sunday readers?
It's been different. It's not, you know, I wouldn't pretend it's been difficult, though. You know, we've just had to adapt a little bit. Clearly, there were 3 months, weren't there, virtually, where there was no racing. So there was a lot of reporting about COVID-19 related stories, which didn't sort of mean that you getting outside your front door made a lot of difference to how you reported it. So with nothing going on, you know, that there was no problem with that. You know, I think as somebody who obviously likes to go to the races as much as I can, you know, I spend a lot of my time on motorways going between racecourses, and I live pretty close to the M25, which, like a lot of people who have to use that, always sort of slightly go towards the roundabout to approach it with slight trepidation, looking up at the flashing signs to see if there's a great long queue ahead of me. But the last time I used the M25 was the Sunday after the Cheltenham Festival when I went to do a thing at Sky Racing. And I haven't used it since, which is amazing, really.
So what's your fuel bill been like?
Well, I think I've filled the car up about twice.
That's because the garden centre's 10 miles away rather than five.
well, just about. But, you know, I've seen the cheap petrol and I keep thinking I've got to take advantage of that compared to normal. The whole sort of reporting thing hasn't been too tricky. We've had to adapt a little bit. You know, we've obviously, everybody knows now Zoom means, don't they? You know, and there's been a lot of those sort of remote interviews.
Previously, they just thought Zoom related to your nap in the mail.
Well, Zoom for me was a lollipop. You know, they probably still exist, don't they, Zooms? Right. You know, I'm a bit of a technophobe, but even I found it pretty easy to work Zoom.
And has Zoom been used, say after the 2000 Guineas the other day when Andrew Balding won it with, and Oisin Murphy won it with Cameco? They were obviously both there at Newmarket. So were they put on Zoom to chat to, was it like the Downing Street briefing at 5 o'clock in the evening? Were you all sort of lined up to ask questions? Robert Peston asked about five that were all unintelligible.
I probably played that role. Yeah, at the moment, there are only two reporters allowed on the track. One represents the Press Association and one represents the Racing Post. And they basically are working in cooperation with each other. And any information that they get is pooled and is shared. So we all have sort of access to it. But for all of us who are sitting at home or on our sofas, there is the Zoom opportunity. So yeah, so we after Andrew and Oisin had spoken to ITV and to Racing TV following their 2000 Guineas success, they then came on the Zoom interview, and we even had after Love had won the 1000 Guineas on Sunday, Aidan O'Brien did a Zoom interview from his office at Ballydoyle because obviously he hadn't travelled over with his horses because of the travel restrictions.
And apparently he was a Zoom virgin, wasn't he, prior to Guineas weekend?
All I can say is that before he came on, his wife Anne-Marie was there setting up the system. Now that might be...
You might have just let out a very confidential bit of information there.
But yeah, it's been interesting. I've got to say, I wouldn't want to name names here, but there was one of my colleagues who conducted or took part in the Zoom interviews over the weekend from his South London bed.
From bed?
Yeah, he was sitting on his bed.
Oh, not in his bed. That's a relief. Because well, I think I probably worked out who we're talking about.
Well, I think the duvet kept getting pulled up, I think.
Just as well, so many newspaper journalists have nom de plume, newsboy.
Yeah.
And what you were talking, so that's all worked okay. And you were talking about owners. And I think this is the striking thing about the lockdown, because obviously every sector of racing claims to be the most important. Racecourses think they're the most important. The bookmakers think they're most important because they fund it. Racecourses because they stage it. Trainers because they train the horses. Jockeys because they ride the horses. Stable staff because they look after the horses. Etc. We in the media because we tell the world about the horses. But the owners are the people who have made the investment and pay the bills. And clearly, they're not able to go at the moment. So do you detect racing as a whole and racecourses in particular wanting to give plenty of TLC to these clients who obviously are such an important part of the whole thing?
Oh, definitely. You know, clearly owners have kept funding the sport through training fees and everything right through the lockdown. You know, I think that they were, they were given messages maybe not directly and encouraging them to keep going and paying their bills, not taking their horse out of training in the hope that racing would start up again. So having had them to, you know, making that financial outlay, I think they are, you know, not surprisingly, top of the priority list to get the next raft of people who will be allowed on a race course.
Will that be sooner or later, do you think?
If you're asking me to have a bet or an educated guess, which none of us can really make more than that at the moment, I would think that possibly sometime in July might be possible for a few owners. It's not going to be a great, you know, it's not going to be a fun experience, you know, in terms of, apart from watching your horse, you know, I can imagine, and again, this is just me speculating, that, you know, if you go to a particular race course and your horse runs in the first race, you know, you will turn up and see your horse run the first race, and then you will be asked politely, no, not marched off the race course, but to leave as soon as possible. And if your horse runs in the seventh race, please don't arrive until an hour before and go away, you know, because there will be limited facilities available for them. You know, at the moment, trainers who have horses that run at go to a meeting and maybe those horses are running in races separated by an hour or so, are asked to sort of go and sit in their cars, basically. You know, they're not sort of hanging around chatting and socialising. So that initial experience for an owner will be fairly sort of perfunctory, I think, really. But it's at least it's getting them back on the race course. And you have to have some sort of, you know, you've got to have a plan because, you know, I think owners will be first. I think that race courses will then look to members, because obviously these members have paid their annual subscription
and have been loyal.
And they've been loyal as well. But if they don't get onto any race course at all, you know, you're looking at what scale of refund you're going to have to give them, or what scale of deduction, you know, you're going to give them for their 2021 membership. So, you know, I saw the other day that Glorious Goodwood have, although they've ruled out a public crowd, they're still holding out for their meeting, which is at the end of July and isn't it start of August, that there might be some sort of admission for members. And again, I'm only guessing at this, but I would imagine it wouldn't be everybody there potentially at the same time. It would be asking members, which day would you like to come? And maybe you can come 1 or 2 days of the 5 days. And, you know, we have to go through all these stages before we get to looking at basically then admitting the public. And I think the earliest possible time for that will be September. And again, that is really the earliest possible time.
Well, I've heard some people from ARC Arena Racing Company who run the St. Ledger at Doncaster in normally on the second or sometimes the third Saturday in September. I think it's the second this year. Hoping that they might get some people in, because the people of Doncaster love that particular event. So they'll be hoping to try and get some people in. Look, time is nearly upon us, but we've already touched on the fact, Marcus, that owners think they're very important and you've been an owner, that the media thinks it's very important and you've been a member of the media. And jockeys obviously think they're very important because they ride the horses. And unlike practically every other member of the media, apart from Derek Thompson, I think, so you've been compared to Derek Thompson here, and in the past, Owen Bruscott, obviously, you've actually ridden in a race. Now, I haven't got masses of time for you to talk about this, but you finished third in a charity race at Windsor, and you worked hard to get...
No, I didn't finish third.
Were you fourth?
No, I think I was sixth. Fortunately, the form book doesn't record the result of the race. I think it was sixth, and I wouldn't really want you to ask how many runners were in the race.
Well, I was deliberately going to say third, fourth, fifth, or sixth, and not say last. But I thought you were a bit closer than that. But in a couple of sentences, how you talked about being a part owner and how that gave you an insight. Being a charity race jockey, albeit briefly, and you know, we all took the Mickey out of you like mad at the time, but we were actually hugely admiring of what you pulled off. How good did that feel to actually have had the wind whipping past you as you charged down the race course at Windsor?
It was exhilarating. There's no doubt, it really was thrilling. Just the sort of the mud being fling back in the hooves and hitting you, you know, it was really something special, you know, and I'm so pleased I did it. It was a great experience. It got me to experience, even in a very minor way, because I wouldn't pretend I was experienced what proper jockeys experience, but just the, you know, we all watch a jockey and think, oh God, why did he do that? Or why didn't he do that? You know, the speed at which things happen and your reaction times, especially when you get to the higher levels, obviously. I think I've gained greater experience of that. But if you're asking me what the greatest experience of it was in the actual build-up and going into a stable for about 6 months beforehand and seeing all the lads, the grooms, the girls and the boys are going every morning on all weathers and turning up and riding horses that are fractious and are difficult. And, you know, on a Monday morning, they turn up and they're all frisky and the chance of getting thrown off are pretty high. I think I appreciate what they do more than ever, really. So it was great to do. And I'm really pleased I did it.
And we started by talking about the camaraderie of the racing press room when you walked out of the weighing room that day at Windsor, having completed your racing career? Did you miss the camaraderie of rubbing shoulders with Dettori and Moore and all these, James Doyle and William Buick and all these legends of the turf?
Well, I'm sure they don't talk about that experience, but to be in the same way, when Frankie was there, I remember Freddie Tillicke was there. Freddie was really, you know, he shouted across at me across the weighing room, wished me good luck. Tom Queeley was really good to me. Do you remember Frankel's jockey, Tom Queeley, who, you know...
Was he friendlier to you as a fellow jockey than sometimes he is to the media?
Sometimes Tom can be a little bit cold to the media, can't he? But he's been okay with me generally. That sort of really sharp left-hand bend after the finishing line at Windsor, you know, he said, "Look, just make sure you do this, because if you steer towards the inside, because if you go to the outside, these horses can suddenly see the exit and whip round, and you know, even experienced jockeys can go straight on while they're turning right." So
and the River Thames is pretty close.
I know you want me to wind up here in a way, but I will just finish by saying this, that there was a headstrong horse in the race which was rated far. I was on a horse who was basically a two miler on the flats, and it was a 6 furlong race. So it was a very, very safe conveyance. Let me underline that. But within the race, there was a horse which was trained by Gary Moore and had been brought specifically for his amateur jockey to ride in these, or well, not amateur, charity races. This lady was going to ride him, and she was probably a decent horsewoman. But this horse was just an absolute lunatic. You know, it just galloped and galloped and galloped. And when we got there, there were a few stories about how this horse had been charging around the gallops at Gary's yard. Anyway, it was led down to Hayley Moore, Gary's daughter, led this down to the start. And we weren't any starting stalls. We just sort of lined up and the flag went and we dropped. And this horse, which shouldn't, I think it was rated about high 80s, I think it was. So it was rated easily best horse. Anyway, it didn't win. But as we went round this left-hand bend at Windsor, we were all pulling up, and my fellow was really very tractable and gave me a dream sort of ride.
My fellow, you're sounding like a jockey already.
Anyway, I looked up into the distance, and all I could see was this horse in front of me galloping on and on and on. And so anyway, he just went into the distance. Anyway, none of us saw this, but in the end, the only way that this lady could stop, she had to actually jump off, you know. So it was the perils of being a jockey. But Mick Fitzgerald said to me about it, and again, that was a Grand National winning jockey, far, far, far more experienced than me. He said about, you know, the great thing about a jockey is, you know, you can see when dangers are coming. You know when to sort of just maybe put your foot on the brakes, because you can, if you're like when you're driving down the motorway and you look ahead of you and think, oh, there's a bit of, you know, just ease off the accelerator a little bit. And professional jockeys or experienced riders can do that sort of thing. People like me and the people who are riding, a lot of the people, not all of them, are riding my race, who are just sort of having a bit of fun and having experience, we can't do that. We haven't got the experience to look around. We haven't got the sort of the innate jockeyship to spot dangers before they hit us in the face. You say about, did I miss the camaraderie? Yeah, it was great to be in there for one day and it would be a treasured memory, but I think I got out at the right time.
Well, look, we're going to have to get out now. The right time has approached us. Thank you very much to Marcus Townend, Captain Heath of the Mail and correspondent as well of the Mail on Sunday. Thank you as well to you for listening to the Cornelius Cast. Have a think about this. Please subscribe and then you won't miss an episode. Speak to you again very soon for the next Cornelius Cast.